from Athletes on the Rise with Coach Don Showalter, the head coach and coaching director for USA Youth and Sport Development. How you doing, Coach Show?
Good. Appreciate being on, Eric.
Yeah, super excited to have you on here today. So we're going to jump right in. So obviously I've been in front of you and some of the things you've been doing at Snow Valley and been watching you with Team USA. One of the biggest things that strikes me is how you'd be able to create such a championship culture in the way kids, you know, work with one another and interact with the coaching staff. And, you know, there's this feeling once you walk into the gym. How have you, first of all, before we jump into those details, what is your definition of culture? What does that consist of?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, because I think, you know, culture is kind of a term that's used a lot these days and kind of maybe used more than it should be. But I think, I mean, to me, culture is just is how you do things, you know.
Right.
You know, includes your expectations, includes your standards, but it's really how you go about doing things is your culture, mm-hmm. And that includes not only you know, your staff, coaches, but you know, the players and everybody involved in your program. What goes, you know, really what goes into that? What you know, what you expect from that?
So, and is that just on the court? Is that also how you're trying to develop, you know, how you present yourself before, at, during, and then after training and competition? Or is that just on the court, so to speak?
Well, I think, I mean, obviously on the court, but off the court is really important too. You know, how you portray yourself as individuals. And, you know, now in this day and age, you know, with everything going on, you know, with the racial matters and unrest going on, I think it's really important
that
you give players some ways to express themselves.
Right.
And I think that's part of the culture. I know a lot of programs are going through a lot of different things now. How do they allow their players to express themselves for the racial injustice that's going on? And I think it's really important that we as coaches take a look at that, and that's really part of our culture. And you know, I think 10 years ago we tried to probably suppress, if that's the right term or not, but suppress players and ideals that they had because it was out of the realm of sport. And and now with everything else the way it is, you know, including the coronavirus and racial injustice is going on around the country, I think it's really important that part of our culture allows those players to be heard and also allows them to, you know, to express themselves in ways that maybe we would not have done 10, 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So within that conversation then as coaches, how can we encourage that rather than, you know, try to, you know, suppress it or tone it down, as you said?
Well, I think, you know, I think we first of all, I think trust is a big factor in whatever we do. And of all the pillars that we have with USA Basketball, I think trust is the one that kind of comes out probably on top, because it's really, if the players trust the coaches trust the players, that has a lot to do with you know, how the players feel about the program.
Mm-hmm.
You know, success has a very, I should say, success has a certain feel to it, type of thing. It has a certain look to it, has a certain sound to it. And so I think, but that involves, the success involves really the trust that goes on in the program itself. And if there's no trust that goes on, I think that really allows a poor culture, and it doesn't allow players to have that freedom of expression that they would normally have if the trust wasn't there. So I think coaches really have to build up trust, and that's on a daily basis, both on and off the court. Culture is a daily basis. You build your culture both on and off the court. Culture is made by your standards. What kind of standards do you live by? And then you try to express that to your players as well, because regardless of what their situation is, standards are, are kind of things that guide each one of us. And some coaches mm-hmm. call standards non-negotiables. I look at it a little higher level than that. Instead of rules, standards are something that we try to live up to. And, you know, trust is one yeah. of those. Communication is one of those. All those things deal with building your culture and building your trust with the players.
Okay, so within that, on you know, what are some things that you can coaches and players consciously do to help you know build that trust?
Well, I think first of all, whatever coaches, whatever you promise to the kids, you better follow through on. I know early on in my career, I probably didn't realize that was such a big thing to play. You know, if you promise them a meal or a pair of socks or whatever for winning a free throw contest, and you don't deliver on that, then they've lost a lot of trust in you. Right. And I always tell coaches, promise less but deliver more. So, you know, you're not going to promise a lot, but you're certainly going to deliver a lot. And I think that just raises the level of trust. And then communication is such a huge part of developing trust with players and coaches. And I know my last position of high school coaching at Iowa City High was one in where the program had been struggling for many, many years. And, you know, one of the things that we had to do is establish trust with the players and the parents. And we did that by, you know, a lot of communication. And I didn't realize as a young coach how much that communication was so important with players and parents. And, you know, we did that a number of ways. I'd write emails to the players' parents or whoever they were living with in that situation. But I would write an email to the parents and just keep them up to date on what was happening in our program so they could follow our right. program. I would also do, maybe after practice, I would write one individual or one, send out one email to a parent and just say, hey, Johnny did a great job today in practice. You know, he may never start for us, but he was really good tonight and he added a lot to our team. And so I think that those really positive comments, and I didn't always used to do that in my high school career, but those positive comments certainly raise the level of trust with the parents and the coaches and the players, because now Johnny will go home and, you know, whoever reads that email will say, Johnny, you must have had a great practice today. And Johnny goes, what? And he said, yeah, I got this email from Coach Show, and he said that you had, and so it develops that trust, and
right.
pretty soon, I mean, those players will run through a brick wall for you. And so I think that all goes into then the freedom of expression is they're going to say some really positive things about your program, but also feel free to raise their level of awareness about, you know, for instance, social injustice. So
right.
I think that's, you know, and culture is different. And I'm sorry if I'm rambling here, Eric, but
no, not at all. Not at all.
Culture is really different than chemistry on your team. Mm-hmm. You know, chemistry is how people relate to one another. And I think sometimes that gets mixed up with culture.
Yeah.
And culture is how they behave, you know, together for common good. So it's really two different things that determine chemistry and culture, because, you know, your chemistry maybe is how two players interact and get along with each other, or three players or whatever on your team. That's not necessarily culture. Culture, right. you know, right. is how they behave together as one unit for common good. And so I think that's really important that coaches understand as well. And culture can be certainly, it can be influenced by the environment, by economics, by many, many different things, depending on where you're coaching at.
Mm-hmm. So with, obviously there's going to be a different cultures for different teams. How, as a coach, do you determine, what are the values that I want to establish for this program?
Yeah, I think that's happens on a yearly basis. I think you kind of have to evaluate your team And, you know, based on what your team makeup is, you know, whether it's diversity, economics, and all that other kind of things, that I think that determines a little bit about your culture as well. But I think there's some really stable things with culture that coaches need year after year after year. I'll go back to trust. I'll go back to communication. Those are standards that I think are really important and is part of your culture. And culture, like I said before, is how you do things. So, you know, if you think that, you know, one of the small things that we have is we always meet before practice for maybe 2 minutes or 5 minutes or 10 minutes, whatever, and go over our mind candy for the day. Our mind candy is just a phrase that, that we give our players, and they write it down in a notebook, and then they give two or three sentences about that mind candy based on our team. So what you're trying to do there is you're trying to develop communication, but you're also really trying to develop, what is the culture of our team, and have the players think about how that mind candy is important to them and our team. And then, you know, just little stuff like, do you allow players to come on the court with their shoes untied to start a practice? Mm-hmm. You know, no, you don't. I mean, we don't. That may not bother some coaches. So that's a little thing, but that can be part of your culture as well. And culture isn't necessarily discipline. I think too many coaches think, well, if I don't have great discipline, it's not part of my culture. So culture really is again, you know, how you do things and the respect that's shown toward players and coaches, the trust that's shown, and then you build on that. I go to a lot of practices. I do it with the virus lets up, but I go to a lot of practices, both high school and college practices. And so I see a lot of different, really a lot of different, I would say cultures, but more so how different ways that coaches do things. And there's really not one right way or wrong way. I think you getting the respect of your players and the trust of your players, and it probably has more to do with that culture. And then the coaches can go off on different directions based on their team. You know, I'll go watch Tom Izzo practice, and, you know, obviously his culture is very intense culture, where they come in and they're, you know, rebounding is a big thing with him, and it's very competitive type of thing. I'll go to Jay Wright's practice, and it's much more fundamental based, and then much more of chemistry based, where the players, you know, really work together type of thing. So I think coaches tend to think that it has to be the same year after year after year. One thing I will say is that once you kind of establish your culture with your players, then you have to have some form of, all right, if this is our culture and this is what we believe, and you make a poor choice, then you're going to be held accountable. Because, right, you know, choices are, we tell our players that you as a player have a lot of different choices to make, but you have, but you have no choice as to what's going to happen for your choice being made. You know,
freedom of choice, but not freedom of consequence.
Exactly right. You've heard me say that before, probably. But, yeah. So I think that's really important that you get across to your kids, and that's just a whole baggage. And then you know daily you have to really have players talk about your culture and talk about things that make up your culture on a daily basis. Obviously, you have to kind of fight for your culture daily, because if you don't, you're going to have some slippage in what you have. And, you know, you can't treat one player different than another player, on the court. I mean, I think if you have, your non-negotiables need to be, kind of the same for everybody. I have said in the past, though, that, you know, you develop, you know, each player develops a sense of what is fair for them. You know what I mean by that? If a player comes to practice late one day and he's never done that before, and he's been great in the classroom, and he's one of those kids who just, you know, one day made it, just didn't get to practice quite on time.
Right.
As opposed to another player who, you know, who is constantly in trouble in the classroom and pushing a button on being late maybe being sarcastic at times. You know, his bucket isn't near as filled as a kid who only has maybe just one time. So, you know, so you develop fairness, and I think players need to understand that, you know, you earn your fairness. Well, how is that earned? You earn it on a daily basis.
Right. And so you talked about cultural cornerstone, or the culture, it's not discipline. It's how you do things. And so, for example, Izzo, you know, he's really intense, is really emphasizes the tough rebound. Jay Wright, you know, super fundamental based, you know, how does the team work together? What is it within the common teams that you have coached, you know, both at the high school and then at the national team level, or even, you know, taking looking at them from separate lenses, that are your cornerstones that you would have, you know, build daily, cultivate daily?
Yeah. Well, I think, I think a couple of cornerstones is hard work, great attitude, coachable. And I think you need to call out your players if they're not working hard, or if that's one of the things that you think is part of your culture, and then it's not happening, then I think you need to call out your players on that. Hey, look, one of our standards is we're going to work hard every day, and I don't see that happening today, maybe, for instance. And so I think you need to call out your players on that. This all goes back to practices too, and because players don't come ready for practice. So I think that's a coach's job to get players ready for practice by how they conduct practice, how they start practice, how the practice flows, how the coach will make sure that the practice flows in a pattern that you want it to flow as a coach, not that the players want it to flow, because they have a different thought about how practices should flow, and as a coach does. So I think you need to hold players accountable for when, as a group, that they're not holding up their end of the deal. When you have playing smart might be one thing, playing, you know, and be in a position where the players are not working hard like you want them to. Then, if that's part of your cornerstones, then I think you need to hold them accountable. That's definitely part of ours. So, you know, I'll stop practice once in a while and just say, hey, listen, this is unacceptable. This is not what we want. This is not how we want to be. This is not how we want to be seen as a team. And again, this is part of the culture, because you are, you know, we're teaching them how to behave as for a common good. And it might be another thing might be, you know, coachability, being coachable. If you think a player is not being coachable, I think you need to pull him aside and make sure that he understands how you view that. Because a lot of times players don't know how coaches are viewing them with their body language and effort and those things. And I find out, really, players want to get better, and they want to be held accountable. And so, you know, there's situations come up where if you don't hold them accountable, I think that they're actually disappointed. And if they trust you that, hey, I'm doing this to make you better, you know, a lot of times I'll ask them questions, hey, how much better do you want to get? And we'll ask our junior national team players this all the time, because, you know, they obviously want to get to the NBA. Well, if you want to get to that level, you know, here's what I'm seeing, and then and you let them kind of figure it out. You know, well, maybe coach is right, type thing. Again, you know, really goes back to trust, but, you know, hard work, being smart, is huge. You know, a lot of times, a player will take a shot, and I may stop practice, or I may pull him out and say, ask him just on a one-to-one, Now, was that a good shot or was that a poor shot? And it might be a good shot, and I want him to know that was a good shot. Or it might be a shot that he's, yeah, it wasn't, you know, I was being guarded probably too close to make that a good shot. So just things like that where they were, you make them think about, all right, how smart a player am I? How hard a worker am I? How coachable am I as well? So I think that all has to do with, you know, how you interact with the players on the practice court.
Yeah, so I mean, at the end of certain plays, just, you know, yeah, getting their feedback, letting them have a voice. And, you know, obviously, depending on their personality, sometimes, like you said, you have to pull them aside one-on-one there so they can communicate it better. And some of them will be able to communicate to that, to that group as well. Okay, so like if you're building the cornerstones, hard work, you know, being coachable, having a great attitude, being smart. And then you also talk to, if these are your cornerstones, you're having them fight for it every day. And you're also having them kind of connected to things you will do with mind candy in the beginning. So is that how you would basically get them ready for practice? Like, hey, these are our main things. You know, here's a thought. And, you know, Jimmy, you know, or Steve or whatever, what does this mean to you? You know, how does this relate to our team? You know, that's kind of how you start to get them mentally engaged, getting them going.
Yeah, really. And then so they come, you know, I always say players come to practice with, you know, they might have had a fight with a girlfriend, a teacher, had a bad test. So I think you really have to get them on the same page for practice. And we just call it practice ready. You know, how practice ready are we? And so we do it by the team meeting we have. We might have, actually, you know, we might, some days it might be 20 or 30 minutes for that team meeting based on what's happened at school, know, what's happened in
the world.
In the world, exactly.
Yeah.
And you want your players to, you know, to be intelligent enough to really think through things, you know, before they just spout off. And so I think, you know, this is a great time for communication with that. But then I think when you start practice, we always start practice with something that is competitive. In other words, we have what we call our Texas drills that we start out with. It's a series of four drills based on passing and catching and shooting and layups and stuff. And we time them, and they have to get a certain amount in a minute. And so that really gets them in the flow of practice and sets the tone, we say, for practice. And then you can go off on your different areas of practice. But I think that's so important that, you know, that's done. As a young coach, I probably didn't do a very good job of that because I think I did let the kids kind of shoot on their own a little bit or just do some things that were not probably that they were getting a lot out of. So, boy, when we step on the court, we want them to feel that practice has started here, and that we're going to, here's our expectations that this is going to be competitive. Here's what we got to get, 50 layups in a minute or whatever it is. You know, we got to get that today. And that really sets the tone for practice. And then, you know, then we go on with our normal practice. And I think to me, a lot of times I'll go right into our defensive part of practice because that's the hardest, the highest intensity part of practice. Kids always want to do the offensive part. So if you wait to that till the end of practice, they're still going to want to do that. Sometimes the defensive part is going to be harder. It's going to take more effort, and you know, they're not going to be quite as fresh. So if you wait till the defensive part to the end, then it kind of drags for practice a little bit. But so I think that's really important how you construct your practice, how you organize your practice. It, to me, is the whole key to how your team really develops throughout the year. You know, you might have 70 practices through a high school season or whatever it is, but you know, our team, I really felt, for the most part that, later on in my high school coaching, I really felt our team got better as the season went on and really reached their peak at the end, right before tournaments. We always played, I thought, exceptionally well in tournaments. And I think part of that was based on our practices throughout the whole year, where we still worked on skill development from day one through day 70. And I go to practices now, high school practices, where if it's the end of the year, you know, there's very little skill work or skill development because they're doing scouting reports and walkthroughs. That's okay, but I still think there needs to be some really strong skill development work in that.
No, for sure. So if you're looking at, so if we're talking at the high school level, you know, you mentioned about, you know, having defense in the beginning of practice after you have the competitive stuff. How does that, ever vary throughout the season? Because I know I've been exposed to a wide variety of coaching, and some groups did it like that. Some coaches would have it, you know, a defensive day, and then another day would be an offensive day. You obviously have your scouting day. How does that structure kind of work throughout the year to allow you to, like, you know, get them ready, maintain competitiveness, but then keep the intensity throughout the entire practice, no matter what?
Yeah, I mean, we'll switch that a little bit, but we're pretty stringent on, you know, starting out with our Texas drills, making something competitive. Then we might go right into what we call cutthroat, 4-on-4 situation, where, you know, it's very highly competitive and you have rules, and players love that part of it too. And so I think, you know, what you're trying to develop is, you know, a toughness in your team. And, you know, if you're going to define toughness, can be defined a lot of different ways.
Right. That's one of those words. Give us your definition and how you develop it. Cause that could be a whole podcast. Cause there's so much stuff that's thrown out
there. Exactly. Well, you know, basically I just define, for me, toughness is really how you focus when you're fatigued, you know, cause players, you know, players can move. You know, players are so, you know, if things are good, if they're not fatigued, boy, they can do a lot of great. I've seen, you know, not only with my teams, but with our junior national team, when they're feel good and they're not fatigued, they're really good. And all of a sudden fatigue sets in, and then they're not very tough. They can't focus. So that's a huge thing for us. I think that's really how I define tough. And when I go watch players play, and for our junior national team as well with USA Basketball, when I go evaluate players, I want to see what kind of focus they have when they're tired and fatigued. Yep. And I think it says a lot about them as well.
No, I'm sorry. No, I'm glad you brought that up, because I think a lot of coaches and players in general miss out on that from a number of different standpoints, where, you know, on my side, I do a lot of skill development. I do a lot of one-on-one stuff, but it's getting the kids and the players to understand that, okay, it's, you know, whether it's in a team setting, an individual setting, if you're doing something fresh, yes, you're going to be feeling good, but can you do this skill perfectly right the same way when you are dead tired, when your legs are heavy, when your lungs are burning, and you don't feel like you can go anymore? Can you still perform? Can you still what your responsibility is, what your role is, when those opportunities come up when you're 15? So I really enjoy that definition.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think when players, you know, we call fatigue a separator. And when we start to cut players or reduce our squad for USA Basketball from 35 to 14 to start with, or 15, whatever it is. But, you know, we always say fatigue will be a separator. And those of you who aren't tough enough to focus through fatigue will be cut. And, you know, and also this is going to be a lesson for you down the road in college or in the NBA, because when you're dog tired, you have to be able to hit a shot. If your number's called, you have to be able to hit a free throw. You have to be able to stop your opponent when you're dog tired. And that's all part of, you know, being tough, as I call it. And you know, you look at being tough, diving on the floor after loose basketball and taking charges and rebound. That's all part of it. But I think really it's the ability to focus during fatigue is that part of it.
Got it. All right. So going into the development of culture and toughness, I know those are two separate entities, but, you know, slightly intertwined. What are the most common errors you see in programs that are trying to develop a positive, a successful culture, but might be going about it in the wrong ways?
Well, you know, I think, again, there's so many things that come back to the word trust for me. I just think there's so many things that, and how that's developed is part of your culture. And, you know, I go to practices and watch high school practices and college practices and even NBA practices. And I, you know, you watch the really good ones work as coaches, and boy, you know, they're great communicators. You know, they're just, they know when to communicate. They know when to ask players questions. You know, the Jay Wrights of the world, Tom Izzo's, they know when to push a button for a player and when to take the finger off that button. And that goes back to, you know, care. You know, when they know you care for them, they know you have their best interest in mind, you know, that all comes back together. And so I think, I always say, to go along with that, I think as coaches, you know, players don't have bad practices, in my estimation. Coaches do. And so if you have a bad practice, and I always told my assistant coaches this, when they would say, man, we just didn't have very good practice tonight. And I go, well, then we better look ourselves in the mirror, because something we did not allow a good practice. And I think I said, coaches really have to bring two things to practice every day: enthusiasm and passion. If you bring those two to practice every day, your players will feed off of what you bring. If you just come and do a drill and just stand there and watch with your arms folded at half court, that drill won't be very good. You've got to really be involved with what's going on the practice court. And sometimes that's not easy, because you might have had a bad day as well. And so when you come to practice, you know, where's that enthusiasm? Where's that passion? Because that's going to direct how your players are going to practice. But also, it's also how they know that you care about them, and that care, that, you know, if you show some care toward your players, and by with enthusiasm and passion, it's amazing how they feel that because you care for them, how much they can do extra.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, going off this piece of bringing in enthusiasm and passion, are there any times where, because I've seen that, especially at like the middle school and high school level, sometimes they rely on the coach completely for that energy and enthusiasm. And so it's like, all right, well, if coach is all up, now I'm up. But if coach is silent, now I'm silent. How do you make that transition where you as a coach can step away, not say anything, and then the, you know, the players own it, where it's like, this is our culture, this is who we are. I don't have to say a word, you know, like as a coach would say, and I was playing overseas, like, you know, I can sip my coffee and read the newspaper and you guys are at your peak level. Like how do you get to that point?
Well, I think you target some of your players for that. Yep. I mean, we'll have, there'll be maybe one or two times for sure during a season where it will be all a player led practice, and we'll film that practice and let the players decide what drills they want to do, how they conduct practice, you know, who's in charge, who shows leadership, all those kind of things. I think that says a lot. We try and do that, you know, one time early, kind of early in the season, and one time mid late season. I think that says a lot about your team as well. But then I think you have to pick out players that you know have a high energy level. And you might say today, before practice, I might say, all right, hey, Johnny, you're going to be the energy giver today. So how this practice goes is depending on you. Not me as a coach. It's going to depend on you. And so I think you give them some, you give them that kind of attitude that, you know what, how practice goes is going to be reflected on me. And so you give them some ownership to it. And you might say two or three guys or whatever with that. So I think that's important as well. But you're right. You know, at some point they have to bring it too. Generally speaking, when you bring enthusiasm, passion, especially at the start of practice, you're going to find out players bring that with them. Mm-hmm. Very few times do I remember that I had to have, that I was the only one through the whole practice that had that enthusiasm or passion. I mean, obviously your assistants have to too, but pretty, I think there'd be maybe not all 15-year players, but maybe 10 of them will realize that, you know what, I can bring this the same amount of level of passion as a coach does. So I think really overall, if you start that, it's hard to get that going during the middle of a practice. If you think your practice is dragging, it might be because you were dragging at the beginning of practice. I think if you bring that to the start of practice, then I think the players have a good sense about that. And then, a lot of times what'll happen, if I don't feel we're having a very good practice, I'll say, we have some drills that we do that really bring out the competitive nature of kids. It might be cutthroat. So it might be in the middle of practice, if I feel practice is kind of getting a little bit stale, I'll say, all right, we're going cutthroat, and we'll have, here's the rules, and we go into it. And those kind of drills, you know, bring out the competitive nature and bring out the enthusiasm and those kind of things. So, you know, as a coach, I think you just kind of have to have a feel for that sometimes during your practice sessions. Those are things that, that you kind of feel and how to bring those out in the individual players.
Got it. Yeah. So, you know, to kind of sum that part up, I mean, bring as a coach, make sure you're bringing energy, especially early on. And as the season goes along, you're going to find those people that have the energy, and, you know, just kind of reinforce with them, you know, before practices, like, hey, this, you know, basically this one's on you. If we have a good practice or, you know, high energy or low energy like this, it's going to be due to you. Yeah. And then, you know, give them those opportunities to run it on their own and see what they do, you know, see what they catch on to, see how they're able to interact and help one another. And within that small little subtlety, as far as, you know, kids leading, you know, a lot of times they go from, they're going to reflect from what I find the coach's leadership style, but sometimes they also reflect some old habits that they might have, you know, off the court, so to speak, where, you know, they get very much into people's faces, or they're kind of condescending with some of their tones. Right. You know, how do you approach those conversations and help, you know, make those subtle changes to help them become better leaders within those areas?
And you raise a really good point, because a lot of players don't really know how to lead. You know, they're just not, their makeup isn't, I don't know how to lead my teammates in this area. And again, I think this is chemistry. It's not necessarily culture, because you have to have, you know, good chemistry. So I think a lot of times, you know, as a player, or as a coach, you know, you bring these leadership qualities out very subtly. Let's say, I might say, all right, give me four lines, no more than four at the half line. Well, you know, you can see who's going to be there and lead and get their line in order. And so, for any behavior that you like, for any behavior that you want to see, then I think you make a positive comment on that. So if I want to see Johnny be a leader, every time he leads, I would say, hey, Johnny, nice job being a leader. Or I would say, if somebody's being sarcastic or not being a good leader, I might pull him off the side or during a drill and just say, you know what, how would you feel if I said that to you, type of thing.
Right.
So they get the idea of, oh, maybe I should have said this a little bit different, type of thing. And then, you know, chemistry, it might be two kids that don't like each other. And that happens all the time on a team. So I think you have to deal with that as a coach, and from communication part too. I mean, you have to deal with that as with those two individuals maybe individually first, then as a group of two. But you know, you put them in positions to lead, and you do that with your drills. You do it, you do it by calling out. I always say coaches need to be when they see something that I like as a coach, or when I see something I like as a coach, I have to be sure and call that out, because I want that action, whatever it is, to keep continuing. So let's just say Johnny gets a great rebound and I don't say anything. Johnny's not going to keep doing that for us. But if I mm-hmm. call him out by name, say, Johnny, that was a great rebound. You came from this side of the court to the other side of the court to get that rebound. Now, first of all, a role is established for him, because he thinks I'm a good rebounder, if I can do that. And now I'm established in the fact that every time he does that, I'm going to make a comment on that. So he feels pretty good about that. He has a place on the team by a skill that he is did really well. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that makes sense, but I was going to say we need to catch our players doing what we want them to do and then acknowledging it.
Right, exactly. Positive reinforcement. You see the good, reinforce it. Let them know that they're doing a good thing. Make them feel good and make them want to do it again, so to speak.
Yep, exactly.
So how does let's transition. We've been talking a lot about high school programs, and those are built throughout the entire, you have this long season, very often from October through sometimes March, April, in that area. National teams, those are a little bit different. So how does that transition happen from when you go to the national teams that, okay, we have to establish this culture, but we have this short amount of time to do it? What challenges does that pose? And then what changes that have to be made to help keep that solid?
I get that question a lot, because that really is one of the things that probably is the toughest thing for us to do. Mm-hmm. We used to, early on, we started our U16, U17s in 2009. Mm-hmm. And let me back up a little bit, just a quick history with those teams.
Yeah.
FIBA started the U16 movement in 2009, and they dropped U20, U21, and 22 teams. They just felt that the older, it just didn't make any sense.
Right.
Those kids in college. And so when they started with the younger teams, that was really helped with USA Basketball. I mean, that was one of the things that probably has helped us more than anything. Now, having said that, so we have players come in. For instance, our first team in U16 team in 2009 was Brad Beal, Andre Drummond, Quinn Cook, Michael Gilchrist. So we had them come in 2009. And then we played in a tournament. That tournament was a qualifying tournament for the next year's U17 World Championship. And a qualification was just North and South America. So we had to finish in the top three or four in U16 to qualify for the Worlds. And I say that because the Worlds then includes teams from all different five zones of the world.
Right.
Our zone is just the Americas. There's Europe, Africa, Asia, Oceania.
And then Americas.
In the Americas. So there's five different zones. So So having said that, then we invite about 30, 35 kids in for our U16 team. And we have them for about 2 weeks before we go on the road with them. And so what we really try and establish, because all those 35 kids are coming in, they're the best players on their team. They basically can shoot the ball whenever they want to on their high school team, because they're the best shooters, at least from the standpoint of if they don't score, their team struggles. So we have to really change that mindset a little bit when they come in. And we try and do that from day one, with just our how we say things and how we do things, from the standpoint of you know, making the extra pass, what we emphasize, making the extra pass, our drills, our team oriented drills. Here's what we want to try and get from this drill in our session. So we make it much more of a team oriented drill where, yeah, it might be a good shot, but here's a better shot. And a lot of players at this level really hadn't thought of that. And so let's say the next year, then we have basically the same players come back again, which really helps us because now we have the same group. Take away a few depending on their seasons, but we'll have about 35 players come in again for U17. Probably 30 of them have been there with U16. And so now we're going through the same thing again. So we really get better as during those 2 year stints. And then the last 4 years, we have had mini camps where we bring in players four times during, the players will see each other and work with each other four times during the year. Once in April during the Final Four, we'll have about 80 players come in and divide them up into older and younger players. July, during the live period, we have a session. October is our big one in October. And then again, June, whenever we have a training camp. So really now it's a little easier because we see those kids more often. We have more access to them. So they know what we are all about from the USA basketball standpoint. And we definitely, you know, we have sessions with them off the court on life skills. We have sessions with them about nutrition. So we're really trying to give them many, many different things to help them become a better player. And I think when they're really open to that because they want to become a better player. And so now when we're back on the court, you know, our culture is, you know, trust, communication, all those kind of things. We talk about our team meetings and we really hammer the fact that, you know, we're all playing for one thing, a gold medal representing USA basketball, which is pretty special. And so the guys that buy into it, you know, end up being the ones that travel with us. We have guys that really don't buy into that, and we don't take them with us. You know, we cut them, which is something that you can't do as much with your high school team as you can right. with this team. So I think that's really played a big role for us with as far as how we develop those teams you know, we pick out leaders on those teams. You know, Brad Beal was a great leader for us, and we would refer to him a lot sometimes in our team meetings as well. We'd ask players, you know, what do you think would make you our team better? I mean, what can we do to make our team better? They would give, you know, so it allows them to have some ownership, and I think it's good both at the regular high school level and this level, because we find out that our junior national team players, all our players in the United States play, you know, you play for your high school or you play for your AU team or your club team or whatever, you know, and you never play for your country. I mean, very few players ever get to play basketball for their country. Right. You go to war for your country and you represent your country. But so a lot of players don't have that really pride in, as much as we see from teams like Spain and France and Argentina, you know, because that's a real prideful moment for them to play for their country. And that's what they, you know, they don't have that high school team. So the highest level they can do is play for their country. And so we always try and give them that feeling that, you know, this is special. Yeah. And it seemed to work out really well for us.
Okay, so going into a little bit of the selection process a little bit, I mean, how are players found? You know, how do kids show up on the map, so to speak?
Yeah, well, the interesting thing is, I mean, in our country, we have a ton of scouting services that rate players, and we're not really big on rankings, but we do look at them. We talk to coaches, assistant coaches that are coaching at Power Five conferences to see who they're recruiting or looking at, and then between me and another Samson Coyote here in the office, we actually go see every player we invite. We do not, whether it be in the summer circuit, whether it be during some of the big tournaments that happen throughout the year, such as City of Palms or the Hoop Hall Classic or whatever, we actually go and watch players that we think might be that we might invite, because we want to see how they interact with their teammates, because there's a lot of players that are really good. I mean, there are literally thousands of players that are really good, but you know, what separates them, we always say, might be things like, you know, work ethic, your body language, attitude, coachability, things that don't require much talent. So we want to see those things from a player. I want to see how he is when a coach calls a timeout. I want to see how he reacts when he's taken out of a game. I want to see his body language when he's sitting with his teammates. You know, those all, I want to see is how he warms up, those kind of things. So, you know, we go watch, really, we see everybody we invite, and I don't think we miss too many players. And we have people that say, hey, you need to really see this player. He's really good. And he might be really good in that area. He might be really good in the Midwest. But overall, you know, he's a good player, but not elite good, as we would call it.
Right.
So that's kind of how we do it. And, you know, we do find players that are under the radar that don't make the scouting services when we go look at players, which is kind of fun. We Davion Harmon was probably not really highly recruited. He's at Oklahoma, had a good freshman year, but he wasn't one of those that was ranked in the top 10 or 12. I think he was like 40th or 50th. Romeo Weems played for DePaul, had a great freshman year at DePaul. He was like 80th. You know, those guys both started for us. And so, so it's kind of fun to find those kids and see how they're, you know, see them progress as individuals and players. But we do see everybody. If you would tell me, hey, this kid's really good, we would find out where he's playing at, who he's playing for, high school team, and then also club team, and then we'd actually go watch him.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So, yeah, so for any of that type of stuff to happen, they obviously have to have created a name at some point. So, and I've talked with other, you know, national scouts as far as how they go along and do that. And a lot of them, it seems not that they're completely specializing in the sport, but they start taking the sport, you know, pretty seriously at a young age at that stage, you know, looking at, you know, probably by at least 12, 13 years old, where they're like, you know, they're putting in the time, you know, like, this is what I want to do. And yeah, because you do have to kind of create that name. So to be able to get into that power conferences, from what I've heard with some people, a lot of them, they're being seen at younger ages, where they're just kind of put on the map, and
right.
Yeah, but they put a lot of work into to get there too.
Yeah, and I think, you know, a lot of people are confused when we don't pick players that are really good at a certain grade. It might be a ninth grader that's really good, because we the grade has nothing to do with it. They have to be a certain age. Right. And so a freshman, we get this a lot with our U16 players. Freshman's really good. Well, he's a year older than he, you know, for, we're looking at kids that were born in 05 and 06 for next summer's U16. So we see kids that are right now as freshmen that they're really good, but they're born in 04. And so people don't understand the age thing. And sometimes I say, well, you know what? He should be a little bit better because he's a year older than other freshmen type thing. So people don't quite understand that, you know, we really don't care what grade they're in as far as when we look at them, they have to be meet a certain age requirement. And that's not from our standpoint. That's FIBA. That's the international basketball, you know, U16, right. U17. So we find out that we have a lot to, sometimes that's a hard explanation for parents or club coaches or whatever. Mm-hmm. No, he's too old. Mm-hmm. What do you mean he's too old? He's only a freshman. Well, he was born in 04. We need him in 05 type thing. So
you mentioned a little bit about Harmon and Weems, about how they weren't necessarily nationally ranked, and you know they were, you still found them and they were able to put themselves on the map. Has anyone else come to mind? I was just like, man, we had no clue about this kid, but when we saw him, we knew that this kid had something.
Well, I mean, there's kind of a lot of kids in that kind of category. I mean, obviously, you know, when they're, you know, your Justice Winslows, Tyus Jones, Jabari Parkers, you know, Kevin Knox, those. I think one of the kids that kind of, that we were really high on that maybe did not get as much publicity as we thought, Kendrick Nunn. And we kept saying, I mean, I kept telling college coaches, you don't overlook this kid. I mean, we think he's really good. He's good for us. You know, he went to Oakland University, I think, or Illinois, and then he transferred to Oakland, and then he played in the G League for a couple of years. Now he's a starter for Miami. And, right. It's amazing that happened. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think who else would be, but that's a great example. Isaac Okoro, who started for Auburn this year. We kind of got a little bit of a kickback on taking him. We picked him for our Hoop Summit. He made our U17 team. He did not make our U16 team. But here's a kid that, kind of like Romeo Weems and even Quinn Cook to a certain extent, we were just better with them on the court. And when he's being recruited, I kept telling Bruce Pearl at Auburn, I says, if you get him, he comes to you, you can't keep him off the floor because you're going to be better with him. And that's exactly the way we were. He was with us. We were just really good with him. It wasn't that he was better skilled than anybody else, but he just had a kind of a resiliency, you know, a toughness to him that took him beyond what his skill level was. And he's going to be, you know, he's going to be drafted in the top 10 or so, I think, 15 for sure. So those are the kind of players you really love.
And so it was easy. He was one of those players that he did a lot of the intangibles. He was able to focus through fatigue. He was, you know, maybe not the best scorer, the best shooter, but he did a lot of the other little things really, really well. So it just allowed everyone else to, you know, fit into their role, so to speak.
Yep. You know, they were really, you know, they just, you know, Harry Giles is another example. He was injured now a lot of his time in the NBA, but now, you know, he's back. He was a starter for the Kings last year in a lot of games. And Justice Winslow, same thing. You know, we cut him as a U16 mm-hmm. player. Great story on him. Mm-hmm. Really good player, but we just didn't feel he was the level of eliteness that we really wanted. And in fairness to him, he didn't blame anybody. He didn't come back and say, boy, the coaches really shafted me. You know, I should have been on the team. He just went back and worked really hard, had a great year. The next year, we invited him back, made our team. He ended up making the all-tournament team in the World Championship the next year. So just mm-hmm. stories like that, you know, throughout our U16, U17 junior national teams has really been a fun thing to keep track of.
So when you're doing the selection process, obviously, from what I saw watching there down there at the U16s and in Fort Lauderdale last year, I see a lot of interaction with the coaches on the sidelines, and I'm sure there's you know, between the coaches and the players as far as, you know, giving feedback back and forth, like you talked about earlier. Hey, how can we better help you? Yeah. How can we, those type of things? What type of things are going on beyond the scenes that might not, you know, see, you know, that us in the audience weren't able to see? Like, hey, this is what we're talking about in the back as a coaching staff. This is what we're talking about with the players. to make sure, you know, everyone is given the best opportunity to succeed and be their best self on the court.
Yeah, I think a lot of it's film study too.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, we'd have players come in and show them certain aspects of their game in a really highly competitive atmosphere. And I think, we'd show it to them. We might ask them questions about, if we're looking for shot selection and a kid takes a poor shot, we might say, let's reel this back. All right. Now, what are some good choices that we can make on this? I'm not saying that was a bad shot, but yeah. Could we have done something better? And then let them, I should have made one more pass here type of thing. And we would often say to players, even on the court or off the court, if you want a chance of making this team, here's what you have to do. And I might say, you better lock in when a coach is talking to you. If you really want to make this team, you better give him your undivided attention. You better focus. You better lock eyes, and you better learn how to take coaching if you want to make this team. So, we try and give him some of those kind of things as well. And then obviously off the court, you're with them a lot, when you're eating different meals with them. And then I think you get to know them a little bit, their families, brothers and sisters. And that's really interesting, because once you get to know them a little bit, then you have a little bit more of an idea of if they're the oldest, in their family, that means a little more. If they're the youngest and had four other brothers, and they got to fight for everything they got at the table. So it's a lot of that stuff comes out just by getting to know them a little bit. And then, we do a lot of communication within the players. So we always, at some point during the day, we always have our communication circle where we circle up, and then they have to say something about the player beside them that happened in practice or whatever. So you really learn about the players from those different things.
Right. Now, when they get them into practice, like you said before, a lot of them are coming from these programs that are, they're the main guy on the team. And so they come in, there's a little bit more of an ego. And I know you have the way you form the culture is to make everything, team oriented as far as making the extra pass, et cetera. But what other conversations are had or things that the program does that, leave the ego at the door, so to speak, and help them to buy into what you guys are doing?
Yeah, well, it's funny because many times, especially the first couple practices, even though the players are so, they're good skill-wise, they're good in their area, they're really not sure how good they are amongst other really good players. And sometimes their confidence level, I think we have to read that as coaches, that sometimes their confidence level is not quite as high as you think it might be.
Okay.
And so I think you have to recognize that as well, too. But, again, I'm just really pleased how a lot of these young guys, they're just very hungry on getting better. And the coachable part comes from they want you to be honest with them. They have too many people telling them things that are all, rosy good about them, and if they're going to trust you, I think sometimes they got to hear, hey, you're not really very good with your left hand yet. You need to really work on that left hand and making that left hand push pass. And so that's one area that we want to see you get better at. And so I think the honesty comes from they really relish that honesty, because too many times coaches are afraid to tell them because
they're the best player, so I can't correct them type one.
Right. They're worried about them transferring or going to a different club team or, everything else. And so I think coaches sometimes get caught, and even regular high school teams get caught on not coaching your best player as hard as you should. And that's what we try to instill in these players. you're going to be coached hard. But the reason you're going to be coached hard is because we want you to reach the level of ability that you came here to get. We want you to be that NBA guy. We want you to try to help you become a that player that that everybody wants to draft or recruit.
So explain coaching hard, because there's different styles or understandings or thought process to that too, right? Because you have the concept of, okay, Bobby Knight coached really hard, but you know, Coach K coaches really hard. Jay Wright coaches, but they coach hard in different ways. So, you know, what's your definition of, okay, coaching hard and the different ways you can manipulate those different variables?
Great question. So here's my definition of coaching hard. Mm-hmm. Being demanding without being demeaning. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a perfect way of how you're going to coach hard. You're going to be demanding. You're going to want things done the right way. You're going to want players to, you know what, you better get your wings, run your wings down to the corners. You don't want them to stop at the wings. You want them to go all the way to the corners on the fast break. And you're demanding, but you're not going to demean a kid for that. You know, you're going to say, well, can't you run any faster type thing? Or, you know, those type of things. So I think that's really my definition of coaching hard, being demanding without being demeaning. Demeaning can be sarcastic. It can be, you know, a little bit of making fun of their abilities, whatever. When you do that, you've lost them. But if you're demanding and they don't feel demeaning by that, why, I think that's coaching hard.
Gotcha. All right. So we're coming to the towards the end here. We'll talk a little. I just want to hear a little bit about kind of the skills, things that you see that are coming in at, you know, at that U16 level, at the national team level. What are some of the things that kids do a little bit too much of, and, you know, might spend too much more time on working on? And what's something that kids should probably spend more time on to give them better opportunities to not just make national teams, but, you know, in general at that high school level? What can compare and contrast those two different areas?
Yeah, good question. Well, first of all, I think USA Basketball, we have 8 skills that we think are really, really that we evaluate players on: footwork and balance, ball handling, which includes dribbling and things, shooting, screening, passing, rebounding, then what we call whole offense and whole defense, which a lot of that is 3-on-3, 4-on-4 type stuff. So those are 8 skills that we kind of evaluate players on. Of those 8 skills, we think if you have a practice session and you only have time for 3 of them, you better do shooting, you better do footwork and balance, and you better do passing and receiving. You know, I go watch Jay Wright practice, and his practice is all geared to what is the footwork, getting to the lane, jump stop, and pivoting. You know, pass the ball back out, ball faking, all those things. But that's kind of his practice MO, footwork and balance type thing. Shooting, I think, is something that needs to be, you know, and these skills, I'll go back to saying that, you know, players do not graduate from a skill. Right. In other words, they never get good enough that they don't have to work on the skill. They may refresh the skill. They may review the skill. You know, the best shooter in the NBA, Stephen Curry, you know, he's always working. He's not good enough. He never works on shooting anymore.
Right.
In fact, he works on shooting. He may make 300 to 500 shots after every practice. So I think, you know, those things are something that as a coach, you have to get across to your players that, you know, you're not good enough that we don't have to work on screening. The best teams we play against, Argentina, France, Spain, Turkey, in the past years, are the best passing teams we've ever seen. I mean, they could pass the ball really well. So those are the kind of skills that, you know, that we really look at and emphasize. And I think shooting has become too much. Either you get to the basket and try and finish, or you're a 3-point shooter. Mm-hmm. Mid-range game is kind of lost.
Yeah.
And I was just on a Zoom deal the other day with one of the guys on it was Steve Kerr. And, you know, he just said, you know, we think the mid-range game is still really good. That's a great shot. You're going to shoot maybe 55-60% from that, 65% from mid-range. That's a good shot. But nobody really wants to work on that. But I think high school players need to be good mid-range jumpers, mid-range players. And, you know, floaters, that's a mid-range, as well as so that's part of the game, I think, that's missing a little bit from players that we see coming in. They all want to shoot the three, or they all want to get to the basket and finish around the basket.
Right.
And not all of them are good three-point shooters. You know, they need to be good 15-foot shooters, because that's really going to make more of it. And then I think a lot of kids, especially the ones we give junior national team, they depend way too much on their physical ability to make things go. And so really, you know, they might not be very good dribbling with their left hand. You know, we all run, if you run a dribble drive offense, you're not very good with your left hand. That offense isn't very good. And so I think, you know, those are kind of things that at some point your physical ability is going to have to lend itself to skill. Skill's going to have to take over, because we say all the time, you're going to meet people with the same physical ability as you, and it's going to come down to skill. Are you better skilled than that person who can run and jump as well as you? And if you have that, that's going to set you apart from them, or it's going to put you behind them.
Right. And I mean, when you're looking at long-term athletic development type models as well, I mean, a lot of the, when you take it into the mental, the physical, the technical, the tactical, like that base level is always that skill piece. I mean, if you have a team of extremely skilled players, everyone can dribble, pass, and shoot. I mean, you could run anything on offense and you're going to be successful. You know, it gives you so many options. You know, and I think a lot of times when kids are younger, sometimes parents are like, we got to get them in the weight room. We got to get them to do this. It's like, well, yeah, those are supplementary things, you know, that are going to be later on, but early in life, I mean, set that foundation, make sure they can do these fundamental things, and not just like have them be good at it, but work towards mastery. You know, it's not good enough. You're shooting 5 to 10, like get that to 8 to 10, 9 to 10, 10 to 10 from your different spots, like form that consistency in at game speed, at game tempo. I think that's missed a lot of.
You know, Eric, you said one thing that's really important: mastery. You know, what mastery of these skills do you have? Are you just okay at it, or do you have a real mastery of them? And that's why when I say you don't graduate from a skill, the more skills you have, probably the more often you have to really review and get those skills to a higher level. And so I think mastery is one of those things that is lost when kids work on skills.
No, and it goes back to your toughness, you know, the fitness, your ability to execute when you're fatigued, be able to focus when you're fatigued. It's the same thing with your skill. If you know you've gotten, although there's no such thing as mastery, you're pretty darn good. If you're huffing and puffing, you can't feel your legs or your arms, but you can still, you know, pull up from 30 and like that's going in. Like, and you know, that's when you know, like you're pretty good.
Exactly. Yeah. And just a great example of that is we had a player, I won't mention his name, but we had a player who was really good, but he was really good for 3 minutes. He could not play more than 3 minutes because once he overextended himself, he wasn't very tough, couldn't focus. So we told him, you're going to play 3 minutes, you're coming out of the game. And then he'd sit out for two or three or four, whatever, until we put you back in. So guys like that have to know that, you know what, I need to really extend my ability to focus when I'm tired on that. But yeah, that's a great point.
Yeah, awesome. All right, Coach. Well, thank you very much for your time. Hopefully we can do this again sometime. I know you're a super busy man, but I appreciate you taking the time at the moment here to get together and talk basketball.
No problem. I love to do it, Eric, especially with people like you who are really really conscious about improving the game and how we can improve the game and getting players better and those kind of things. So appreciate all you do for the game of basketball as well.
Same to you. All right. Thanks, Coach.
Thanks.